Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the latest issue of Orion Magazine, today's guest, Dean Kippers, reports that new players with deep pockets have appeared in farm country. Investors are looking to buy up prime farmland and turn a profit on the steady upward trend of land prices and farm incomes. Dean Kippers reports that in the last decade, huge pension funds, university endowments, banks, wealth funds, hedge funds, and new exchange-traded companies have sunk an estimated $25 billion into U.S. farmland. Reports estimate that there are investors with at least $10 billion looking for deals. And this is a global phenomenon. According to the International Land Coalition, between 2000 and 2011, large investors bought or leased more than 500 million acres in Africa, Asia, and South America. That's an area of 8 times the size of Britain. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about why Wall Street investors are buying so much farmland. What are the implications of this? What does this mean for rural communities, small farmers, and the global food system? Today, we're joined by Dean Kippers. His article, Buying the Farm, is in the latest edition of Orion Magazine. Dean is author of Operation Bite Back and Burning Rainbow Farm, and he joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Hi, Dean. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Hi, Rose.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Anuradha Mittal, founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute. Since 2011, the Institute has unveiled land investment deals in Africa and around the world, which it says reveals a disturbing pattern of a lack of transparency, fairness, and accountability. And Anuradha joins us from her office in Oakland. Hi, Anuradha. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Nice to have you. And we're also joined by Philippe de Lapeyrouse, Managing Director of HighQuest Partners. He leads the firm's global food agribusiness and biofuels advisory practice, and Philippe joins us from St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Philippe. Welcome to the show.
Delighted to be on. Thank you.
Nice to have you. So, Dean, I want to start off with you because your piece sparked this show. And let's talk a little bit about where we are. So, going back just a couple of years, you report that after the global food crisis of 2008, land acquisition in the developing world jumped 200% as huge firms snapped up farmland in a kind of frenzy with little regard to local farmers already working the land. Talk about why this happened.
Well, I think that the big investors want to put their money someplace that's relatively safe. They've begun to regard, you know, farmland as a good place to park some of their money. This is probably even relevant to this moment we find ourselves in right now with some stock market volatility. An investor, and I think that it was Philippe who told me this, an investor a number of years ago referred to farmland as like gold but with yield, meaning that the land itself, you know, not only has a value and that is subject to some, you know, speculative pricing, but they also grow crops on the land, which can be sold for good prices. And right now, historically, farm prices are pretty high. So this is a pretty good place to put money. And it's not terribly surprising that people would try to put some money in into farmland.
And so since 2008, this has exploded. You report in your piece that over the last decade, pension funds, university endowments, and we'll talk about that later in the show, wealth funds, hedge funds, have sunk about $25 billion into farmland. And then between 2000 and 2011, investors bought or leased about 500 million acres in Africa, Asia, and South America. And Philippe, some people might be raising their eyebrows thinking farmland is a relatively safe investment. Why? How does that work exactly?
Well, farmland is depends on when. Everything depends on timing and when you invest. But obviously you're buying you're investing in a real asset, which can't be moved. If you have a clear title to the land, you own the land, and so it can't be taken away from the owner. Dean just said, I mean, the references to, you know, it's land is like gold with a coupon. Gold doesn't produce anything, so it's not a producing asset, whereas farmland does produce crops and not only broad acre crops, which are the oil seeds and grain crops, which are extensive agriculture, but there's a lot of investment going into permanent crops as well, fruits and vegetables and stone fruits and nut trees, not only in the U.S. but abroad. So this is we see this as a very positive thing. I mean, you know, for investors to have some exposure in this area as opposed to just paper assets is attractive. And it's opening up opportunities, particularly for young farmers who don't have the capital to buy land. If you take the U.S. as an example, it enables them to expand their operations and to get into the business, whereas if they had to own the land outright themselves, it would be a big drain on their capital resources.
And so, Philippe, I'm not sure if that's your line. We'll try to – actually, it is. Okay, we'll try to fix that. While we do that, Dean, give us a sense of, you know, when you talked to investors, what did they tell you about why they're buying up so much land? Because, again, we're talking about a lot of money here.
Well, I have to say, first of all, that I didn't talk to any investors because I went to a lot of these, you know, my interest in starting the story was really in these couple companies that were trying to do something that was an alternative to this, the Iroquois Valley Farms and Farmland LP. Those were the two companies that I did talk to. And put in a request to talk to some of their investors, but people were a little bit shy and didn't really want to be, you know, on the record on some of these things. But I talked to enough of the advisors and the people who run these companies to, you know, to get a pretty good feel for it. And there's kind of two prongs to it in that one is, as we've been saying, it's a, something of a safe harbor for to put some money in and own a real, you know, a piece of real estate, a real investment, own some dirt, to put it, you know, that way. But also the other thing is to do some good. A lot of people like the idea of owning a farm. They like the idea of putting their money someplace where they believe that it's going to be growing food, doing some good things for, you know, for real people. And there's a certain good feeling about that. And that's something I think that, you know, people with the wealth to buy things would have been doing since time immemorial. It's really not that unusual for instance, you know, a family office of a wealthy family to own farms where they, you know, not only go ride horses and do fancy things, but also grow crops and sell them and do that to as a way to own real property and to make a profit. I do want to correct one thing that we've been saying in the show so far. This whole, the idea of the 500 million acres that were bought or sold internationally since between the dates between 2000 and 2011, I think it's more accurate for us to say that there's $500 million in deals that were put in play during that time, and not all of those deals have happened. And in fact, a lot of these the NGOs that are out there, like the Transnational Institute, International Land Coalition, and the Oakland Institute have been tracking a lot of those deals over time. Some of them will probably never happen because of local politics in places like Africa or Southeast Asia, but a lot of them have happened, and it's more accurate and interesting, I think, to think of this number as like the number of deals that are around the world now that are in play, but you know, we don't know how many of those will actually land or not.
Well, so I got this number from your piece, and you cited a study by the International Land Coalition that found between 2000 and 2011, investors bought or leased more than 500 million acres in Africa, Asia, and South America.
Right. I'm not sure that that's actually that they bought, that those deals were done. That's what I'm trying to say, is that those were deals that were put in place, but I'm not sure all of those actually happen. Those are deals that they're tracking. That are, you know, are things that could happen down the line.
And Philippe, you're back with us, and I'm still trying to get a sense of why this is a relatively safe investment. What are you hearing from investors today?
Is that asked?
Yes.
Being asked for me?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, safe investment. Nothing. Everything has risk. So, I mean, if you're getting a return, it's because there's a certain amount of risk associated with it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be getting that return. But it depends on where one's investing. Obviously, investing in the U.S. has a little less risk associated with it than if you were investing in Brazil or some other market. Australia also offers a fairly safe investment profile, as well as does New Zealand for investors, because of the the common law and land registries and the fact that you're dealing in an English language. Though even there, one needs to be, when you're going into new markets, one needs to be careful. But what I think needs to be pointed out, and something that came up in Dean's article, is this whole concept of sustainability. The return that investors are looking for is predicated not only on the current return that they're earning from crops that are grown and then sold within a year or whatever period, but it's also the long-term appreciation of that land. And so an investor has every reason to want to operate sustainably, because a big piece of the return is going to come from the land appreciation, and that land appreciation won't exist unless they've nurtured the land and husbanded it correctly. And so I think it's a little bit of a misunderstanding that people are going in and just basically pillaging the soil and using it up. That's not at all what is driving investors here. They're trying to invest in an asset that's going to hold and be valuable over the long term. And by that, I mean 25, 30 years or longer.
Well, and so let's talk about that, because Anuradha Mittal, founder and director of the Oakland Institute, your organization put out a report last year saying that the wolves of Wall Street are eyeing millions of acres of farmland that will soon come up for sale, much of which has been in the hands of family farmers for generations. This is according to a study called Down on the Farm. And you report that these owners see $1.8 trillion in land that could be exploited for industrial farming as well as fracking and fossil fuel production. You also told Dean in the story that this farmland could be turned into a golf course, for example. So what is your main concern about this trend that we're seeing? Anuradha?
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, the report that you mentioned primarily looked at the change of land within the United States, where you find Wall Street investors moving in. And it looked at the trend that over the next 20 years, where nearly 400 million acres will change hands, will that land remain with the family farmers in the United States, or will it move not just to big agribusiness, but really people who have had nothing to do with agriculture before? These are your pension funds, these are your private equity hedge funds. Now, our concern is really, it's really who owns the land. It depends how the land is used and how it is cared for. It was just mentioned around the world, that trend has been going on since 2008, when we saw the food price crisis happen and we saw the financial crisis happen, which has driven the interest of the investors. In our work, where we have looked at hundreds of land deals, where we hear the language of sustainability, we hear about this is going to promote food security, it is going to create jobs, going to create infrastructure in places like Africa. What we have actually found is either lands being taken over. These are not unused lands, but really they are being used either for growing biofuels, or they are being used to grow, say, palm oil plantations or foods for export. So you can imagine countries like Ethiopia, where on one hand you have trucks full of food aid coming in and you have trucks full of, you know, crops that have been grown in Ethiopia leaving the country. And also we have seen lands, for instance, in Sierra Leone, in Mozambique, and places, lands which have been secured just to be sold at a higher value to another investor. So there is a lot of land speculation that is happening, contrary to what was just told to us right now.
And so, Anuradha, when we look at the farm landscape around the globe, is there any way of knowing, you know, what percentage of the land has been sold for a higher price? What percentage of the land is growing food specifically to be exported?
You know, that's an excellent question. And actually, when the figure was used around 500 million acres of land, I would say that's a very conservative figure, because a lot of these land deals are happening on the side with no transparency and accountability. So as an independent think tank, when we wanted to look at the impact of these land deals, we first thought we could just go to the capitals, meet with agriculture ministers, get details. So for instance, one of the land deals, which was the largest land deal in Tanzania that nobody knew about, that the Institute exposed, which involved 800 acres of land, nobody even knew about it. So all the tracking that is happening by being on the ground, speaking to the communities. There is no openness around it. There is no accountability, and that is happening against the violation of the consent of the people on the ground.
Philippe, what about that? Why aren't landowners being more transparent about what they plan to do with the land?
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, that's an accusation, but I think we need to distinguish between...
Well, wait a minute. Let's just hold on that, because I want to make sure we get all the information and the facts right. If Anuradha is saying that they went to the government to find out what's being done with these hundreds of millions of acres of land and no one knew...
Well, first, as Dean mentioned earlier, there are a lot of deals that have been announced that are apocryphal, that never got are probably never going to see the light of day. You see press releases and whatever, but they're not, I wouldn't say there's a number of them won't see the light of day. I'm not arguing that there aren't sometimes things that are done that haven't been done in an orderly fashion. And obviously in some of these countries, particularly as you look at Africa, governance issues are a big issue. But I would say that if someone's got institutional investors, particularly those from the West, and I'm talking about that engage and follow best practices and follow guidelines established by organizations like UNPRI that have established guidelines based on the FAO and guidelines for responsible investing in land tenure, are loath to invest in any deal that's going to have an impact on their reputation. So a lot of these deals that are being cited as poor examples are not being undertaken by institutional investors in the West. By the West, I mean Europe and North America. And a lot of these deals that are don't pass the smell test never get their feet off the ground. If you're going to be producing crops in an interior region and you have a situation with the nutrition, you're not going to be able to get those crops out if you don't have a population that's willing and is accepting of what's going on in the local region.
And now, is there a way to find out how much land is being used for palm oil, for example, or for foods that will be exported, or land that has been sold for a higher price? Is there a way to get that information?
Well, land transacts because it does get a higher price because there's a willing buyer and a willing seller. But the example of Ethiopia is a little disingenuous. Each country, each region has a specific expertise and can grow because of their climate, can grow certain crops that are prized in other areas. And for instance, in Ethiopia, yes, they're exporting coffee. Why wouldn't they? It's a cash crop. And they may be importing some other foodstuffs, but actually Ethiopia is a very interesting example of a country that's experiencing a tremendous growth. Sometimes with tremendous growth, there tends to be maybe some examples or situations that need to be reined in. But overall, I think the phenomenon is positive. But if you look at the U.S.,
let me just ask Anuradha to comment on what you just said about Ethiopia.
Well, around Ethiopia, it's not just about coffee. You have fertile lands being taken over, which were used by agropastoralists for growing crops and for the cattle now being used to grow cotton and sugarcane, especially in Lower Omo. But I think in case of Ethiopia, we just talked about high growth. I don't know if you're familiar that the UN has just put out an emergency appeal asking for food aid for Ethiopia. This is an area which has been targeted by investors. But let's not talk about Ethiopia. Let's talk about some other countries. For instance, there are investors where very much the Western institutional investors are invested in. For instance, Chetan Atlas, who is actually, their people are speakers at the ag investment conferences, who actually boast that they have an agreement with the government of Zambia that they can export foods even if there's a shortage of food within the country. So I think if you go to some of the ag investment conferences and you look at the portfolios of these companies who are offering anywhere from 20 to 25% returns, there is no such thing as a willing seller because we don't know who those sellers are, because these are rural communities, these are indigenous people, these are people who don't have land titles like we do, but they have customary land rights. And these are people who are being expelled from their lands.
Anuradha Mittal is founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute. Philippe de La Perouse is managing director of High Quest Partners, where he leads the firm's global food agribusiness and biofuels advisory practice. And Dean Kipper's article, Buying the Farm, is in the latest edition of Orion Magazine. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. That's what sparked today's show. Today we are talking about Wall Street investment in farmland. Over the last decade, pension funds, university endowments, banks, hedge funds have sunk about $25 billion into U.S. farmland. Reports estimate that investors with at least $10 billion are currently looking for deals. So what questions do you have about this? What are the implications of this? What does this mean for rural communities small farmers and the global food system. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you work on a farm, if you work in agriculture, if you're from another country and you've seen this play out, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. So Anuradha, again, the Oakland Institute has done a lot of reports on this. When you look at how globalized the food system is becoming today, and also how corporatized the food system is becoming, you know, what is your main concern about investors buying up so much farmland around the globe?
Well, I think, Rose, the biggest concern is that the investors are moving into farmland, not because they have some noble intention of feeding the world. These are the myths that we are finding have been perpetuated. They are moving in with the hopes to make a lot of money, which there's no problem with that. But the problem is in terms of when people are displaced from their lands. So globally, we are finding, whether it is Latin America, whether it's in Asia or in African nations, a lot of these so-called land deals are not happening when the people have rebelled, whether it is, you know, Bolloré from France and Belgium, whether it is emergent investment in Matuba and other places where the land deals have not gone forward, or whether it was Summit Farms investment from Iowa in Tanzania. Those land deals have not gone forward when people have found out how they're going to be displaced from their lands and they've been able to internationalize their struggles. Within the United States, I think we have to be concerned about other things. For instance, given the drought that we have here in California, when institutional investors are moving in, they are looking to have crops planted, whether it is nuts such as almonds, which will find ready markets in Asia, never mind the kind of water usage we will see. So I think on one hand, we have displacement, lack of consent of local communities around the world. We have seen growing poverty and food insecurity in third world countries as small family farmers are displaced from their own lands. And then in countries like the United States, what we are seeing is, given the climate change we have, given the kind of droughts we have in California, the last thing we need is institutional investors moving in who have nothing to do with agriculture, using third-party farm management services, farming our lands in a way which is basically raping our soils and destroying the environment.
And we're going to go to break in a minute, but Philippe, is there any way to know how many of these investors do have experience with agriculture and how many don't?
Well, I think, I think we're talking about different worldviews here and how things move ahead. This is a great story about capital coming into an industry that was starved of capital for generations, for decades. Now, agriculture has always been very innovative, and the perception is that it hasn't been because it was hidebound and because it was following old practices. But in fact, that's not the case. But what agriculture has suffered from a lack of investment over the last since the Second World War. Largely because the markets were contained, and now that the markets are global, there's demand growing, particularly in Asia, but not only in Asia, and also in the Mediterranean basin and North Africa and the Middle East, where the demographics are quite strong, a strong family formation, young populations. But this is a great story about capital coming in and bringing in new technologies and new approaches to producing sustainably. It is a complete and utter misunderstanding to think that small stakeholders are sustainable producers over the long term.
Well, hold that thought. I'd like to get Anuradha to respond to that and then for you to respond to some of Anuradha's concerns. Today we are talking about why Wall Street investors are buying up so much farmland. We'll be back after this.
Your call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join us on today's conversation. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you'd rather write than get on the phone, you can send us an email question or comment. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And then at noon today, Bina from our friends at the San Francisco JCC.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of China's economic slowdown and the U.S. market crash, which got wall-to-wall media coverage in the national and international press. How are the media reporting on the underlying reasons for the meltdown, and how accurately does the stock market reflect the current state of the U.S. economy? How many people are actually affected by the stock market? And then, speaking of food, on Monday, we'll have a conversation with public interest attorney Stephen Drucker about his new book, Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, how the venture to genetically engineer our food has subverted science, corrupted government, and systematically deceived the public. That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about why Wall Street investors are buying farmland, and we're joined by Anuradha Mittal, founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute. Since 2011, the Institute has unveiled land investment deals in Africa and around the globe, which it says reveals a pattern of a lack of transparency, fairness, and accountability. Philippe de la Perouse is managing director of HighQuest Partners, where he leads the firm's global food agribusiness practice. And Dean Kippers is the author of, or the reporter behind the story, Buying the Farm. It's in the latest edition of Orion Magazine. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about farmland? And if you work on farms, what are your thoughts about Philippe's comment before the break that agriculture has really suffered from a lack of investment? And now this is exactly what land needs, is Wall Street investment, and small farming is just not sustainable in the long run. 866-798-8255. Before we get to calls, Dean, what are your thoughts on what Philippe just said based on the small farmers that you interviewed for your piece, that sustainable small farming or small farming is not sustainable in the long run?
Well, there is a point to be made here for instance, the Wilkin family that I talked to, I went down to Illinois. They're sort of a rarity in their area in that they farm organically. And the focus of my piece in Orion Magazine was really some alternative approaches to this investment, these investment schemes where you can help promote, you know, sustainable farming and, in this particular instance, organic farming. Now, the Wilkins, they rent a lot of the land that they farm, which is not terribly unusual for farmers around the U.S. or even around the world. And they had trouble getting more land. That was just a fact for them. Right now, they're, you know, you always think of an organic farmer as being somebody who has like one little patch of vegetables of maybe 5 acres or something. But the Wilkins farm 2,300 acres. And they're very good organic producers. They make beautiful food, and they want to make more. And one of the things that they did about in 2007, the Wilkins helped found this company called Iroquois Valley Farms. And the way that this functions, Iroquois Valley Farms, is they are an investment firm. But you put your money into accredited investors only. We'll put in their money into Iroquois Valley Farms, and they will spend that money on a farm that an organic farmer already has their eye on, and will go through the 3-year process of, you know, of turning over to transitioning to organic farming, and then it will be an organic farm from that point on. And IVF goes on to own that land, but they offer, after 7 years, they offer the farmer the option of buying the land if they've done well and they now have the money to actually purchase the land outright. So there is a need out there, I think, especially for small farmers and in this case, organic farmers, to get capital so that they can expand their operations, which is something that could be good for everyone.
Well, it was interesting to read about this because, of course, you know, we are in the heart of the buy local movement. We're lucky to have so many farmers markets and access to so much organic food. But I would venture to guess that most of us don't really know what goes on behind the scenes in terms of the land. Is it bought? Is it leased? The struggles that these farmers have to deal with. So what else can you tell us about what you learned about organic farmers when it comes to actually buying land, leasing land, and making money?
Well, it's hard. That's the most important thing, especially if you're young. Now, one of the reasons why I went to the Wilkin family is Harold Wilkin, the father, has been a farmer for many, many years. But his son, Ross, was just out of school. I think he went to the University of Illinois in an agriculture program. And coming out, he could work for his dad. But if he wanted to get a start by himself as a farmer, it was very, very difficult. There are a few programs out there through USDA, young farmer programs that help people find loans and going through their local farmers' banks. There are ways to do this, but it's pretty difficult. And they, once again, went to Iroquois Valley Farms. And just a couple years ago, Ross bought his first piece of land, 62 acres, which he also wants to put a house on someday down the line. But he's only like 23, 24 years old. This is a pretty encouraging news that there was a place he could go to and could still be an organic farmer and could find the money for him to start his own farm. And they have IVF has a couple stories like that. They had another guy named Andy Ambrioli in Indiana, and a couple more, I think, in Michigan, that are young people trying to get their start. That's pretty important, because this is the kind of thing that really, with the sort of the big institutional money we've been talking about through the first half of the show, that's not something that's happening with those monies.
Well, we have a related question, so let's hear from Steve in Oakland. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
So my question would be about an organization called Grasslands LP. I heard about them on an online interview, I think, but I couldn't find any information further. Has anyone heard about them?
Yes. Yeah, Grasslands LLC. This is another organization. It's not, I wouldn't say it's similar to Iroquois Valley Farms, but it has a similar goal. Started by Alan Savory, who's a sort of ranching and grasslands guru, a person whose work started in Africa and was really important there in increasing the sort of the a holistic grazing of grasslands. His whole point of view was that putting cows on grass is good for the grass, much different than our views here in the U.S. Over the years, where people mostly regarded cows as a plague that were, you know, eating the grass down to a nub and then moving on. He had found that if you did this sort of categorically and methodically, that grazing animals were actually good for grass, and that there was a way you could do it. And I understand that that Grasslands LLC is also carefully buying ranches, or helping people buy ranches where they can keep cattle on and grow strictly on grass.
We're familiar with them, but this Philippe. Is Philippe speaking. I think what was interesting in Dean's article and what he was just referring to, this is all being supported by capital, by investment capital coming from so-called Wall Street. Wall Street is nothing but a collection of groups that are consolidating portfolios, investment portfolios of small investors to invest in this area. And what we see this capital coming in is creating opportunities for inventive new approaches to growing food, both organically or conventionally, in a sustainable way. This is what's so exciting about it, is that people are experimenting with new models. So, you know, organic non-GMO is a big business and it's growing. I'm actually chairing a conference in Minneapolis at the end of September where we'll be discussing this, because there's support that's being required for this industry. But capital is supporting that sort of local production, small farmers. New technologies are being developed that will enable people to farm on smaller lots for producing and servicing rural local communities. So this is all part of what's going on, is a kind of a renaissance, and what's driving it is capital coming in. It's allowing people to experiment.
And are you connecting with small farmers? So once investors buy the land, how are you ensuring that the small farmers don't get kicked out? Are there relationships there?
Well, I mean, the small farmers, people either come in from the outside and start up from scratch, or they're from the farming community and they decide that that's what they want to stay in. But one needs to remember that most of the land is owned by either farmers or their families who are absentee landowners. They've gone in to other professions, either within the communities they live in or moved to the cities. So very, very little of the land, I mean, the institutional investors account for very small percentage of total land ownership, farmland ownership in the U.S. And I would also add that the high prices that we hear about, which has subsided over the last year or so, the high prices weren't paid by institutional investors. So there wasn't a grab. High prices were paid by farmers buying contiguous plots of land that made sense for them, and they could justify paying a higher price. They've been eyeing that piece of land for a long time because it made sense to add to their existing parcels. So it's a complete misunderstanding of what's going on in the market. But Wall Street, it's a very complicated process to buy land. You buy it in sections of 160 acres, bit by bit, so it takes professionals to knowing what they're doing. People aren't going in and buying thousands of acres at a clip. Doesn't happen that way.
So, Anuradha, what about Philippe's argument that agriculture is suffering from a lack of investment, and we have seen a lot of articles about just generations of farming is not continuing. Young people aren't sticking with the farm because it just costs too much money and they feel like it's not sustainable.
Well, first of all, I think we need to do one thing, which is that we need to separate what's happening around the world, say, for instance, what's happening in African nations or Asian countries elsewhere, and what's happening in the United States.
Right, and I was referring to the U.S., so yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
And secondly, I think in both, nationally and internationally, there has been a lack of investment. There's no doubt about it. In fact, the third world governments, for instance, were specifically told that you don't have the kind of budgets by institutions such as the World Bank to be putting money in agriculture. So whether it is here in the United States or internationally, you find small family farmers having no access to extension services, having no access to credit, basic services or floor prices for their products. So they have been left very vulnerable. And all of those conditions have really sparked this movement where in the United States, for instance, the average age of a farmer is 58, or the younger generation is not getting into agriculture because you can't make ends meet. You need to have a second and a third job. And that's when the large corporations can move in and take over lands. But in terms of what was just said earlier, that it's not just institutional investors are not buying up lands. I mean, in fact, as an independent think tank, rather than just put out myths, what we look at, the reality on the ground, we do field work. And our field work has shown, for instance, a company that used to be Emergent Asset Management, now called MVIST, where institutional investors such as Vanderbilt University, Harvard University were invested in, had no clue, had never bothered to find out who was being displaced from their lands as they put in their money in investments that were happening in places like Mozambique. They're completely detached. They were promised, you know, high returns exceeding 20%, so you connect just with your advisor at Emergent or wherever that you meet at these ag investment conferences that HighQuest organizes. So you have no connection with the land or with the people who are being displaced or what the reality is. What you're looking at is your high return. And I think that is a fact that is cannot be denied by any talk of sustainability. I mean, all you have to do is show up in these places, meet with the communities, whether it is Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, Swaziland. People are being displaced from their lands because there's interest from institutional investors. And these are not just investors from the Middle East or from China or Malaysia or India, as some media would have us report. Our research shows these are investors coming in from, you know, places like Europe, coming in from the United States. These includes pension funds. This includes TRCREF. It includes, you know, your Dutch pension funds and others, again, who are participating at the ag investment conferences looking for opportunities to get higher returns.
Philippe, what about that? What about the displacement of people specifically in Africa and the countries that Anuradha just mentioned?
Well, I'm not going to argue that there haven't been situations where that have arisen where there have been disputes over land tenure or customary usage of land. But we have NGOs like Landresa that participate in our conferences, and we discuss this issue, and we've had the FAO come in talking about land tenure issues and responsible investing in agriculture with investors who attend our conferences who are considering allocating into the sector. And they're all very interested in hearing about this because obviously they want to make sure that they're following certain guidelines and that they're not putting their own institutions at any reputational risk. So to say that there untoward situations haven't arisen would be silly. But of course, we're aware that there have been situations. But you know, this is all part of a process over time. The reference to emergent asset management was a situation that occurred a couple of years ago, and as a result of that, Vanderbilt and Harvard both pulled their investments out. So, you know, they did react and they took the right action. That said, we can also point, and I won't name names, but I can also cite instances where there have been responsible investors going into Tanzania, creating particularly in the rice production, investing in rice production without grower schemes, where they actually support local farmers who want to grow and providing them with access to markets. That's the big issue that most of these countries have had, particularly for the small stakeholders, is that they've been they're living hand to mouth. They've been feeding, growing crops to feed themselves with very little cash crop capability or ability to market their cash crops to raise income for their families, to pay for expenses, their children to go to school. And these some of these organizations have gone in and provided not only the access to markets, but also the technology and the support. And Arado was correct, is that the whole extension system in many countries in Africa has to be rebuilt. It did exist there in the 60s and 70s, and then for a number of reasons, largely political, those initiatives were left to basically weren't supported.
So let me ask Arado, are there any positive examples that you can point to?
Well, I think, you know, Dean's article mentions some positive examples that we have in the United States. You know, one thing we should remember, just making an investment is not going to fix things. The question is investment for who and for what. Mm-hmm. So the case that was just mentioned in Tanzania about the rice farm is actually Agrica. And in fact, the Institute has just put out a report on Agrica, which is hailed as a socially responsible investment because it has an outgrower scheme. And our field work conducted three times between 2012 and 2014 actually showed that outgrower scheme has resulted in people losing everything that they had, because the way it was conducted, it resulted in people not having markets. They actually went into debt because the scheme required farmers to grow rice in a certain way, buy certain packages of chemical inputs, which increased the cost. So now basically no farmers are left in this outgrower scheme. Mm. So we have really been trying to track a good scheme that can be hailed, which is happening somewhere in a developing country, which has benefited the local populations. And so that's why we looked at the outgrower scheme in case of rice farm in Tanzania, which has been a complete failure. What the people did benefit in that scheme was that they were given training in SRI, ways of farming, and the farmers are finding when they can go and practice it without using chemical inputs, the production has increased. So it goes back to the point that was made in terms of offering extension services, new opportunities for farmers. And I think we need to go back to FAO and UNCTAD reports, which clearly say that if we want to improve food security in places like Africa, the focus has to be on small-scale farming, and that's the solution.
Anurata, is it possible to get that kind of small-scale farming with these massive investments?
Well, I think you have to look at why these investors are investing in agriculture. They're doing it for high returns. When you start expecting 20 to 35% returns through agriculture in places like Africa, that is going to happen through very devastating ways, which are devastating to the communities, which are devastating to the environment. It will happen in ways which will displace people and will be harmful for the environment. So I think we are fooling ourselves thinking that this investment from Wall Street, which is driven by making more profits because there is no other place to stash their money till the next opportunity comes by, it is going to cause real devastation, and it's already doing so.
So, Philippe, how do you deal with that tension? Anurata says the end game for these investors is to make money, whereas obviously the people who are, you know, being displaced are suffering, and their end game is for food security. So how do you deal with those differing goals?
Well, I would withhold. I'm not going to get into an argument about the impact or the success that Agrica has had with its outgrower schemes. Obviously, these initiatives are being launched and attempted. I think that they've been very they were careful and not expecting to bring in a lot of money at a certain, you know, and expect to be, you know, successful within a short period of time. But we do see situations where these outgrower schemes have worked. It does require a long lead time it doesn't happen overnight. And it's a question of changing cultural patterns, but changing the way people produce crops. But you know, what we see, is that they are bringing sustainable practices to these regions, as opposed to for deforestation, which is what's been going on. If you look at Mozambique and other places, without access to new approaches, for instance, we've seen a Brazilian technology and environmental approaches to farming being transferred into Africa, particularly into the Lusophone countries, and that has a positive impact. Everything goes forward, two steps forward, one step back.
Well, so speaking of going forward, I mean, we're almost out of time here, but Dean, currently right now, reports estimate that there are investors with $10 billion looking for deals. So this is not going to end anytime soon. So given the competing interests here, local people, especially when you're talking about very poor people who desperately need food and food security, and then investors who want to turn a profit for their investors, how do you see this playing out going forward?
Well, this is why I wrote the story, really, because I was very intrigued by this company, Iroquois Valley Farms, but it's not the only one. And there are investment advisors all across the country who know that their clients are people who are interested in this and who are do-gooders and want to see something beneficial done with their money. For instance, I talked with a woman named Alexandra Dest, who does Alexandra Dest Investments in Massachusetts. She was launching a fund through her private company. She was interested in what she called beyond organic. She wanted the land to be meticulously cared for. Mm. So, and there's a company that I profiled in the story called Farmland LP, which was started in 2009. It's right there by you in San Francisco. A very smart fellow named Craig Wishner started that along with his farmland manager, whose name is Jason Bradford. And the idea of these companies is really to funnel that money to the small farmer. That's the whole point of it. And for instance, in Farmland LP is a sort of a bigger company than Iroquois Valley Farms. They are looking for higher levels of investment. I think they have a fund that's open right now for $200 million for people to invest in. But on the ground, they go back to, when they buy a piece of farmland, they go back to the same farmer that was farming it before they owned it. They don't just go in with a giant tractor and mow it all down and say, okay, this is all ours now. They go back to the people that were working it originally and try to sort of harvest that original knowledge and that original expertise on that land and work out some new practices to help, you know, do rotations or work on grazing or whatever the kind of things that they want to do with that land. But they do it with the small farmer. I think this is something that's much more positive.
Well, that speaks to a question that we're getting from Larry, who says, what about the fact that arable farmland is a diminishing resource? With population growth and global warming, farmland is only going to grow in value. And if current petrochemical farming continues unheeded, farmland will continue to be degraded. And I'm sure, Dean, the people that you're speaking about have concerns about these issues.
Yeah, this is why they're doing it.
Right.
I mean, if you talk... with David Miller, who's the CEO of Iroquois Valley Farms, or with Craig Wishner at Farmland LP, they will talk your ear off about this, because this is exactly what they're trying to do, is make sure that land, you know, all of us who grew up in the United States, especially through the late 70s, 80s, 90s, saw that all the farmland around our small cities disappeared and turned into suburbs. And that's still going on, because obviously our population is increasing. So these are companies whose actually stated purpose is to try to get land and keep it in farmland so that it remains farmland for farmers rather than, you know, a golf course or a shopping mall or some other kind of piece of development.
Philippe, we're almost out of time, just about 30 seconds to a minute. What about those concerns?
Well, I mean, what Dean, we laud Farmland LP attends our conferences. Why? Because they're attracting capital from so-called Wall Street. So Wall Street is interested in their initiative. And I would also add that last year, the $2.5 billion was invested in early-stage ag tech to develop new technologies that are driving sustainability. And why? Because large-scale agriculture is looking to operate sustainably. Why? Because it reduces their cost over the long term and improves and enhances the value of the land. So this is all, you know, there's a lot of room for a lot of different ways and approaches to farming. We see a lot of monoculture producers looking for alternative crops to add and to diversify their risk in their operations. So, you know, what's driving this are new technologies, new tools for risk management. This is all coming about because of the amount of the capital coming into the industry.
And we've got about a minute left. Anuradha, where do you see this going, and how does the Oakland Institute plan to continue, you know, trying to find this information at the same time that you say it's not transparent?
Well, we are kind of dedicated to working with the communities, and I mean, as you know, we are not looking for bad deals to expose. We are actually hoping that there will be good strategies. The world needs good strategies when it comes to agriculture, which is truly sustainable, which are beneficial for communities. So we'll continue to kind of, as an independent think tank, continue to do our research. We actually spend time on the ground and put forward that information. One thing is obvious, that as long as we keep coming up with voluntary guidelines, as FAO has come up around land tenure, things are not going to change. We are seeing devastating impacts of the interest of Wall Street and institutional investors in land, and we need to have real regulations, which need to happen at national levels in each country.
And Anuradha, are you in conversation with any of these investors to express your concerns?
We have been. We actually talk to a lot of investors. In fact, a lot of investors do come to us who want to do things the right way. Mm-hmm. We, as an organization, do not basically give a seal of approval to any. We talk to everyone. We give them experiences on the ground. We hope that the investors can invest in the right way without harming the communities and the environment. But the first thing has to be about transparency and accountability, and foremost, it has to be with the consent of the local communities. So we are in conversation with many, many institutional investors.
Anuradha Mittal is founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute. Philippe de la Perouse is managing director of High Quest Partners. And Dean Kipper's article, Buying the Farm, is in the latest edition of Orion. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of China's economic slowdown and the U.S. market crash, which sent shockwaves around the globe. How are the media reporting on the underlying reasons for the meltdown? And how accurately does the stock market reflect the current state of the U.S. economy? We'll be joined by McClatchy's Kevin Hall and Salon's David Diane. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Ruz is on as senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.